Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. University of Southampton from the United Kingdom published an article on PLOS Medicine. It says the diet and lifestyle during pregnancy is linked to modifications in the infant's DNA. What does that mean? It means that pregnant women who are obese could reduce the health risks for their infant through improved diet and more physical activity. Now think of all the women who are obese or overweight when they're pregnant, not because of the pregnancy, which is normal to gain weight, but rather they were obese before getting pregnant. They're actually adversely affecting their child's DNA, making them more susceptible to diseases later, including obesity. And this is a high level of glucose in the mothers with GDM have been shown that they trigger an epigenetic, EPI, genetic, G-E-N-I-T-I-C, one word, changes in the developing fetus. And by the way, chemical modifications to the genetic blueprint of the fetus, the function of genes activity for the negative, that results in adverse health outcomes for the child. So this is important. So all the more reason that if you're going to have a planned pregnancy, then be as healthy in your lifestyle and your emotions as possible. In fact, I've suggested repeatedly that before you're pregnant, that's an intentional pregnancy, that you and your partner go through a complete one-year detoxification program to get the heavy metals out, normalize your blood sugar, make sure that any of the epigenetic codes that are a part of your DNA, that those frequencies are not going to be adverse to the developing fetus, because they will be, they are, going back seven generations. And that means the psychological or behavioral detoxification is essential. I've seen the results so many times, including friends of mine that were not emotionally, they were not emotionally stable enough, balanced enough, and they went ahead to have their pregnancy, and then all types of problems occurred later in the children as they grew up. And then, and only then, oh, maybe I should have waited, I should have dealt with these problems, because any problem that you have, stress, trauma, images that are in your mind from early in life, all that is passed on to the developing fetus. Just a suggestion. Take our time, be patient, do the right thing. I'm going to be doing a documentary on having a healthy pregnancy, and then that's going to extend as a series from pre-birth to age 18, because I think that we need new insights into the world we're living in today. So that's just one of the things we're going to talk about today. We have a lot more coming. But also today, I'm going to be getting something that is new and very important. Each day I'm going to be playing a series of commentaries from individuals, plus I've created my own, to address the new or the fourth industrial revolution. You've probably not heard of this. This is coming from a World Economic Forum, and by extension, all the wonderful people, the billionaire class, the 5,000, there's not 5,000 billionaires, a little over 2,000, but the 5,000 ruling class, the Medici in Switzerland for the Davos conference. These are people that do not care what we think, how we live, or the consequences of how they made their money. You have celebrities there like Bono and the Bill Clinton and the Barack Obamas and others, policymakers and opinion leaders. And then they come back and their policies become law. And then we are directed because they control the media. So we're going to push back and show that the fourth industrial revolution, which is going on now, right now as we speak, is impacting you in ways that you cannot imagine. For example, tomorrow I'm going to have probably the smartest mind in America on the program, a school teacher, who is an activist teacher, what do you hear? It's like you ask her a question, and it's like an Encyclopedia Britannica explanation. And she's saying that they're taking young kids in third grade, for example, and they're sitting around these virtual tables, desks, and this is all controlled by big tech, but it's funded by Goldman Sachs, the Wall Street firm. And they're making huge amounts of profit at your kids' expense, and yet it's being promoted across America as such a great learning experience, especially since it can be done at home. And guess who's supporting it? Many of the teachers' unions, starting 3 years ago. So I, unlike others, I have seen no proof at all that the coronavirus was planned by these individuals. I believe that they have taken advantage of the crisis to implement their protocols. So we're going to deal with it. Today, for example, you're going to hear two individuals on the program, Chris Hedges and Matt Taibbi, talking about what happened to journalistic integrity, credibility, honesty, and objectivity. It's gone, 100% dead. Well, why didn't people stand up and stop buying the New York Times or watching CNN or any of the networks, including Fox? Why not? They discuss this. Also today, there is a growing number. Actually, now it's in the tens of thousands of doctors and scientists who are saying everything we're being told of how to respond to COVID when it comes to lockdowns is wrong. Quarantining, wrong. So we're going to hear from two brave medical doctors. One is an MD and a doctorate in legal jurisprudence from Stanford University. She's a scholar and a frontline board-certified emergency room physician. The other is a highly respected cardiologist. So on a regular basis, we're going to give them a voice so they you can hear us, not just me. I've been deconstructing the parts of this. And yet everybody acknowledges the virus is real, it's deadly, it can kill, it has killed, but it hasn't killed the way we were told. It's not going to kill everyone. In fact, there is the common flu kills more people under 60 each year than the coronavirus. That's not me saying, it's them. Also, just out in Denmark, they found that 15 million mink, all the mink in the country, and why they're raising mink, they're going to have to kill them all because they found that they had the coronavirus and it mutated. What's that mean? It means then that individuals have become infected from the mink. So there's animal to human transmission. Yes. And did they put a moratorium on traveling from Denmark to other countries? No. So they could start the whole pandemic all over again. Yes. But now they're promoting vaccines coming out in the next month or two or three. Yes. But what if the virus mutates? Can you then end up having a vaccine and still get this new coronavirus mutated strain? Yes. So we're talking about a mess. And by the way, today, the New York Times on the front page was promoting Pfizer, the pharmaceutical company, and their new vaccine, which has 90% efficacy. Really? Says who? Says Pfizer. I see. Well, then, end of story. Nothing here. Just move on, everyone. Oh, but there is something. We actually, unlike the New York Times, we have credibility and do our homework and are actual scholars. So we'll be completely deconstructing what Pfizer has said and show you a part of Pfizer you didn't know existed, all fully documented. That's our show. We have a lot to share. But, and also today we'll be touching on the environment. And I'm going to read part of a German group of doctors, all top scientists, medical doctors. And I'll read their names and their credentials, and it's German doctor's letter to Chancellor Merkel put an end to the COVID fear machine. So you see, as much as they try to deplatform people, shame people, destroy people, people are still having the courage to fight back. Good for them. So now you know that you should have a healthy diet and lifestyle to have a healthy pregnancy, to have a healthy child. Good. Now, a separate study from Harvard's Dana-Farber Cancer Institute shows that cannabis flavonoids help fight pancreatic cancer. Alec Trebek just died of pancreatic cancer. And do you remember it was about 15 years ago that I had Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, Dr. Michael Schachter. I had about seven different physicians on the show talking about natural approaches to pancreatic cancer, and they had very high success rate, a higher success rate with pancreatic cancer than Sloan Kettering or the other institutions that make their best effort. But no one ever tries the natural. Almost all Americans go towards the orthodox approach for all conditions. When that fails and they're given a terrible prognosis, go home and put your life in order, then they show up at a holistic clinician's office. Well, pancreatic cancer has long been one of the most challenging types of cancer to treat, and it's got a very low survival rate. Hence, it's one of the deadliest types of cancer, with a survival rate of 5 years only being 9%. In fact, it's on track to become the second leading cause of cancer death among Americans. However, a recent discovery by researchers from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute at Harvard University could change the way this disease is treated dramatically. The researchers focused on flavonoids, what we talk about all the time on this show, like eating an onion, flavonoids, an apple, flavonoids, that were synthesized from cannabis, the plant. And the flavonoids are compounds that are found in many plants, vegetables, and fruits. And this one shows significant therapeutic potential for treating pancreatic cancer. In fact, one of the study's researchers, Dr. Wilfred Nagwa, said, quote, "The most significant conclusion is that tumor-targeted delivery of flavonoids derived from cannabis enable both local and metastatic tumor cell kill, significantly increasing survival for pancreatic cancer." So that's terrific, and that's good news, a natural, non-toxic therapy. And by the way, cannabinoids have many anti-cancer effects. One reason cannabinoids can be so effective at fighting cancer is their multiple mechanisms of action. They can stop cells from dividing and trigger cell death through apoptosis and prevent new blood vessels from becoming tumors. In addition, they stop cells from moving into nearby tissue, which can decrease the chances of cancer cells spreading throughout a person's body. They speed up autophagy, the internal waste disposal machine of cells. And just in case none of those effects do the trick, it can also reduce cancer's ability to survive chemotherapy. So this means that even if patients do choose to go traditional chemotherapy for their cancer, they may still be able to benefit from cannabis to enhance their treatment and serve as a part of their overall wellness plan. That's good news. From the University of Southampton, which is in the United Kingdom, eye health and poor nutrition, a high-fat diet, is linked to vision problems later in life. That's what the scientists are warning. So quite simply, all of those foods you see advertised that many people eat on television, high fat, that's all those cheese, and the cheeses over the French fries and everything else, and all the meat and bacon and fried chicken, those are all high fat, and that affects the ability of the retina pigment epithelial cells to adjust to changing conditions in the eye as it ages. In the long run, this disruption can result in extensive damage to the retina and loss of vision. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Molecular Nutrition and Food Research. And, well, one last thing from the University of California at San Francisco. Climate change will give rise to more cancers. Yes. Why? Because climate change is creating wildfires and poor air quality accompanied by high rates of cancer, especially lung, skin, and gastrointestinal cancers. This is what they're saying. And there's nearly 60 studies in the peer-reviewed literature supporting this that the worse global warming, the more major cancers from environmental toxins, including ultraviolet radiation, especially those living in Australia, New Zealand, many places in South and Central America, India. So just keep that in mind. And this was published in the Lancet Oncology. We are 16 minutes into our program. So we're going to hear from two brave medical doctors. One is an MD and a doctorate in legal jurisprudence from Stanford University. She's a scholar and a frontline board-certified emergency room physician. The other is a highly respected cardiologist.
Hi there. Yes, my name is Dan Wogelernter. I'm a cardiologist. Trained at Yale University School of Medicine in New Haven, Connecticut, and I've been a cardiologist here in Santa Monica, California for the last 30 years.
Hi, good morning. I'm Dr. Simone Gold. I'm a board-certified emergency physician. I'm also an attorney. Please don't hold that against me. Mm-hmm. And I practice on the front lines, whether or not there's a pandemic.
Dr. Dan, why have you decided to speak out?
Well, I've decided to speak out because I think that we're dealing with a tragic situation where the scientific process has been violated. Studies have been published that had not been adequately vetted and should not have been published. And those studies were used to terminate further evaluations of hydroxychloroquine. I've decided to speak out because the political interference in the physician decision-making process is objectionable and should not be allowed to continue. There are lessons to be learned from this pandemic on many levels. We've spoken about the dangers and the irrationality of the lockdown process. We've spoken about the violation of the scientific purity of investigation. We've spoken about media presentations and misrepresentations of data. This is injurious to the health of our population now, and I don't want to see this replicated in the future. I think as physicians we have a moral responsibility to protect our patients, to protect the science behind our medical decisions, and to prevent intrusions into the purity of the scientific process by outside forces that may have bad intent. And it's important to speak out. It's a moral imperative for us to speak out and to protect our patients and to protect our profession.
Dr. Gold, why did you decide to speak out?
So I decided to speak out for one very specific reason. That was, I was actually presented with a definite COVID positive patient, and I prescribed hydroxychloroquine and zinc because I was very up on the literature on this, and I got severely reprimanded for it. And I also had received a letter from the state board threatening all doctors, I was just one, with potential investigation into me for unprofessional conduct if I was to prescribe hydroxychloroquine. This was so shocking to me. It had never happened where the government told a physician if they had a right or not a right to prescribe an FDA-approved medication. I mean, that was just a sui generis event that took me by surprise. And I thought to myself, if doctors don't speak up, we're really all lost.
Let me add one other thing, if I might.
Yep.
So I think it's important in terms of people's perspective about the impact of COVID that they understand that the data now show that 99.7% of people infected with COVID will survive. 0.3% die. And the vast majority of those people who die, as we've discussed, are the elderly, the frail, those at end of life. And that's not to say that we don't care about those deaths. On the contrary, we feel that many of those deaths could have been and should have been prevented had the proper precautions been taken, as were taken in the state of Florida, in contrast to how things were handled in the state of New York, state of New Jersey, state of Pennsylvania, where the nursing homes were not protected and were forced to take people who were actively infected. What we needed to do was not lock down all of society, not shut down schools, not shut down all businesses. We needed to protect the elderly, particularly the elderly in the nursing homes. It's a small segment of our population. We could have allowed the rest of the population to continue with their lives, take adequate precautions, but not be completely shut down. The cost of the shutdown, in terms of the physical, emotional, and psychological health of people, is enormous. We've only seen the tip of the iceberg of people who have been shut in, who've lost their businesses, who are facing depression, who are facing issues of mental health because of the consequences. This should never happen again. If we ever face this kind of situation again, we need to learn the lessons from the mistakes in policy that were implemented.
So it recently came out that the coronavirus isn't as contagious as they thought, especially for asymptomatic carriers. Is this big news in the medical field? Have you guys known this? And what does that really mean for, you know, the precautions they've been taking?
You know, whenever you review the CDC studies, you can see that it wasn't affecting young people. This has been, I think, a tragedy that we've locked down our young people. Again, this data is widely available to anybody who wants to search it out. CDC.gov, you can see people based on their ages. And it hardly affects teenagers and youths under 20, 30, 40. Really, under age 60, it does not have a higher lethality rate than common influenza. So I was not surprised.
As Dr. Gold said, I think that the focus should have been on protecting the high-risk population. And we knew from the data that had come out from China and from Italy and from France that the people at risk were the elderly and the frail, people immunocompromised. As Dr. Gold said, young people had very little risk from this infection. They rarely got ill from it. So it was not a good decision to shut down schools, to shut down all businesses. And it certainly was not a good decision to send actively infected coronavirus patients to nursing homes. So the strategy was inverted. We should have protected the people in the nursing homes and given those homes more resources to protect the people at risk. And the low-risk population should have been allowed to live their lives. We could have had some precautions in terms of social distancing and masks, perhaps, but to close down the entire society, when in fact it's just a small segment of that society that's at risk, I think was a tragic mistake.
You know, I work in the emergency department, so I see people of all ages. And my heart would sink whenever I would see a nursing home patient, because I knew right behind that nursing home patient, there's 5 more and 10 more behind that one. It flies through the nursing homes. First of all, they're immune compromised. You cannot be a nursing home patient unless you have a skilled nursing need. These are just not ordinary older people. These are people that have at least one pretty serious medical condition. Many of them have 3 or 4 serious medical conditions. Obviously, this is going to fly through the nursing homes, and they can't fight it. So when I, as an emergency physician, would see people with COVID-19, the ones that got really sick are the nursing home patients. Sometimes a person who wasn't in a nursing home was also sick, very sick. But I almost never see a younger person or a healthy person that was sick enough that had to be even hospitalized, let alone severely ill and needing something like intubation. And always in life, there's limited resources. And the resources need to go where they can be most useful. What we did is we spread all our resources out amongst society at large. That, I think, was criminal and immoral. We needed to focus the resources on the people that needed it, our nursing home patients. As a specific example that I know off the top of my head, in Pennsylvania, the average age of the person who died from COVID-19 was 79. At the same time, the life expectancy was 78.7. So, of course, all deaths are tragic. All of us have parents whom we love. However, it's in a different category when a person who's past the life expectancy passes versus a person who's 20 and passes. So when the average person sees these numbers that are calculated every day, 100,000 Americans have died, they're not able to put that in context because the media is not giving the context. Do you know how many Americans die every year? The average American doesn't know. The question is, how many more people died due to COVID-19 that were not going to already die, let's say within this year? That number is very low. And I think there's going to have to be some reckoning when this is all over, how we really harmed and killed nursing home patients.
Yeah, the data certainly were known. We knew this as early as February from China, from Italy, that it was the elderly and frail who were most at risk. So why did Governor Cuomo and his health commissioner force the nursing homes to take patients? Well, it was part of the overall panic that occurred not just in Hmong society, but in the healthcare industry. The hospitals in New York and throughout the country were afraid that they would be overwhelmed with patients and that they wouldn't have sufficient capacity. And they wanted to offload patients who were no longer requiring inpatient high-intensity care. And they said, we need to let those people go out of the hospital. And where can you send them? Well, there were places in New York where they could have sent them. The Javits Center, which had been equipped, the Navy ship Comfort that had been sent, you know, to the New York Harbor. Instead, they were sent to nursing homes, where it created massive death. This was a tragic mistake, just absolute negligence in terms of decision making.
Yeah, so the Comfort and the Javits Center were shockingly empty. They were almost completely empty, which was amazing. The question of why Governor Cuomo did this, it's very unpleasant to speculate. But one thing that's for sure is it was absolutely known when he made the decision to let the patients go back to the nursing homes. It was 100% known. I understand looking back, people will wonder, was it known? There's no question. You can go back and you can look at the dates of these things. It was absolutely known that it was risky to send the nursing home patients back. You know, the health commissioner of Pennsylvania really had an egregious situation where she took her own mother out of an assisted living facility, but she told the rest of the state that it was perfectly safe to leave your grandparent in an assisted living facility. That's just egregious. There's no question that it was known at the time. I don't know why this was the plan. You know, people always wonder why the deaths were so high in New York. There's no question that the nursing home deaths put them over the top. I mean, you know, no question. And a fact that's often missed is that patients that got sick in the nursing home were often sent to the hospital and died. Those do not even count as COVID deaths attributable to the nursing home. That doesn't even count. So whatever the number is, it's higher.
You have an interesting contrast between the state of New York and the state of Florida. In the state of New York, the nursing homes were not protected. They were not given adequate PPE, protective equipment. They were not given adequate resources, and they were forced by the governor, by the health commissioner, by the mayor of New York City to accept people who were discharged from the hospital and were still actively infected with coronavirus. And guess what happened? Just as what you would predict would have happened, you had thousands of deaths. It's estimated that as many as 40, even 50% of the deaths in New York were nursing home patients. This was preventable. The proof of it is the state of Florida, where the governor, Governor DeSantis, said, let's protect the nursing homes. And his health commissioner said, let's work on protecting the nursing homes, not allowing visitors, checking everyone who comes in to make certain that there's no evidence of infection, giving them adequate resources, and certainly not allowing any people with active infection to go into the nursing homes. So the mortality rate in the nursing homes in Florida was small. And Florida, as most people know, has a large percentage of elderly people, not just in nursing homes, but throughout the society. You have all the snowbirds who come down from, you know, the Northeast. So it shows you, with good policies, with rational thinking, you can protect people, and we could have had a much lower death rate and death count in this country had people followed the policies that were used in the state of Florida.
And there is a lot of talk going around now about hydroxychloroquine. People are saying it's very dangerous. The news is really hammering it. Is that, Dr. Dan, is hydroxychloroquine something that you think is dangerous? Is it something you've prescribed to patients before?
I've prescribed it. I've also recommended it to people, and I've had conversations with physicians literally around the globe, in Israel, in Italy, in England, and the East Coast of the United States. And I've read the literature extensively. So hydroxychloroquine definitely has a role. That role is specific. It's an antiviral agent that is effective in early stages of infection. When used in that context, it is effective and it is safe. Unfortunately, there have been studies that have looked at hydroxychloroquine, but have looked at it in the wrong context. They looked at it in severely, critically ill people in the hospital setting. At that point, the antiviral isn't effective because you've gone beyond viral infection to an immune-mediated widespread inflammatory reaction. So that was the wrong population to look at hydroxychloroquine in. And that kind of study, that sabotages the whole story about hydroxychloroquine. That study, those studies, I'm not quite certain why they were designed that way, but it was obvious that hydroxychloroquine would fail in that context. Hydroxychloroquine has been reported to have heart toxicity, and as a cardiologist, I'm intimately aware of this literature, and I'm familiar with hydroxychloroquine. And the study that was most specific in looking at the cardiac issues, specifically with rhythm abnormalities, was a study done in the East Coast in the New York area, where they looked at 200 patients and carefully monitored their EKGs and looked for arrhythmias, and they found no serious arrhythmias in any of those patients. Some of the reports about danger to the heart and dangerous effects of hydroxychloroquine are based on misinterpretation of data or on faulty data.
Interesting. Yeah, we did see the World Health Organization ordered countries to stop using hydroxychloroquine recently, and they've also stopped trial testing on it as well. Was this decision based on those studies from Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, and JAMA?
Yes, so the World Health Organization stopped the hydroxychloroquine trials based specifically on the faulty studies that were printed in the Lancet and printed in the New England Journal of Medicine. Also, the European Union stopped it, and it was headlines all across the world that we should stop using it. I do want to clarify for the audience that they did restart the trials once the Lancet and New England Journal of Medicine retracted those faulty studies. However, it's not so easy to just, you know, restart a trial, right? You have all these patients, they were in the trial, it had to stop and start and gather new patients. And the damage has certainly been done. And in addition to those...
I'm going to quote you right now before we go to our next video. Disease outbreak news, quote, this is the UN. Circulating vaccine-derived poliovirus type 2, Sudan. On August 9th, 2020, the Federal Ministry of Health, Sudan, notified the World Health Organization of the detection of a circulating vaccine-derived poliovirus type 2 in the country. According to the notification, the virus is genetically linked to the Chad. Sequencing results showed 12 to 19 nucleotide changes. Two acute flaccid paralysis cases were notified. The first case, and it goes into this, and what their public health response is, they're withdrawing this. And the World Health Association assesses the risk of further international spread of this particular polio vaccine, human-made vaccine, not the wild virus, across Central Africa and the Horn of Africa to be high. Did you hear that? The World Health Organization said the risk of further international spread of this polio vaccine across Central Africa and the Horn of Africa is high, with large-scale population movements in other areas of Central Africa and the Horn of Africa. The more thorough region-wide risk assessment is being conducted by the polio program. So you were told that all these vaccines were safe and effective. Well, obviously not in Africa, in other places. Just want to share that. And also I've been telling you that they're misleading the public. Now, they're either as dumb as bricks or they're doing it intentionally, because you're seeing 100,000 people per day, we are led to believe, coming down with COVID virus, and hence disease, a vector, spreading it and dying, or could die. That is not true. What they're doing is they're testing millions of people in the United States and around the world. And the more people you test with a fraudulent PCR study test that has a high degree of false negative and positive, you're going to get more people. And also, you could have an old dead virus particle in your body. The doctor will get back the record that you're positive. Nothing more. Not that you're a healthy individual and this was a cold you had 2 years ago. So there's a difference between a person that tests positive, which is an accurate way of stating it, versus another case. Because the moment you say a case, you're not just saying a person that tests positive for the antibody, but a person that has the virus and it's active in their body. This is how they're continuing to play you. And I have a lot of official statements from doctors on this. Tomorrow, Dr. Ronald Brown, Cambridge University, will be talking about, quote, public health lessons learned from biases in coronavirus mortality overestimation. Huge overestimation. So we're bringing you the facts as quickly as we get them. We're going to go now directly into a discussion between Chris Hedges having an interview with Matt Taibbi. And there's about six well-known journalists. John Pilger, one of the best in the world. Abby Martin, outstanding journalist. Max Blumenthal. And then you have Bing Censored. And, of course, you have Matt and Glenn Greenwald and Chris Hedges. You're talking about under 10 people that will not bend and will not compromise when it comes to finding the facts, whatever they are, and sharing them with you. There's no political, ideological, financial agenda, and they won't bend to public support. And who's attacking them? Well, it was the liberal community and some within the conservative community. But now that Biden will be the president, and by the way, let the evidence be presented, whatever it is, and then let the courts decide if there was any shenanigans in the voting process. You hear all kinds of claims on the internet. Let's just let it work through. And by the way, did I miss something? Weren't many of us supporting the 37 days that this highly contentious legal battle with two efforts at the Supreme Court went on when Al Gore was fighting with George Bush? 37 days it took in challenging the accuracy and legitimacy of the vote. So let's let this work out and then let the evidence be what it is. But now you've got a whole campaign that's going on to silence all critics. Even if you're at the heart of that group of people, if you're the one journalist that stands up and says what we're doing is not right, we've cherry-picked the information, and we've misled the public, can't we tell the truth? And there's going to be there's the door, goodbye. The truth is not being told. Now, let's hear it directly from Chris Hedges.
I do believe, I mean, I have maybe a naive hope that some canny entrepreneur will realize that there's a screaming need out there for a new kind of media product. I mean, I hear it every day from people sending emails that I just wish there was a place I could go to find out just what happened, stripped of all the editorializing, right? Like people want the old school, boring, you know, when, why, where, how, you know, third person, dead voice that we used to get in all these, in all the newspapers, and they're not getting that anymore because everything is highly charged and highly politicized and tailored for a political audience.
Twitter and Facebook blocked access to a New York Post story about a cache of emails reportedly belonging to Democratic nominee Joe Biden's son, Hunter, with Twitter locking the New York Post out of its own account for over a week. This overt censorship is emblematic of the widening and dangerous partisan divide within the U.S. media. News and facts are no longer true or false. They are divided into information that hurts or promotes one political faction over another. While outlets such as Fox News have always existed as an arm of the Republican Party, this partisanship has now infected nearly all news organizations, including publications such as the New York Times and the Washington Post, along with the major tech platforms that disseminate news. The division of the press into warring factions shreds journalistic credibility, creating a world where facts do not matter and where a public is encouraged to believe whatever it wants to believe. Joining me to discuss the rapidly disintegrating media landscape and its consequences is the journalist and author Matt Taibbi. So Matt, you've, I think, written as well on this as anyone in the country. And I want to go all the way back to 2016 because it's not a new concern for you. But let's begin with 2016, which was awful, now it's worse. Can you talk about the progression?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think what happened in 2016, and it's kind of been a story that's assumed biblical importance for people in the news media. We had this episode where a cache of emails that had come from the Democratic National Committee and from figures like Tony Podesta came to be in the public sphere through groups like WikiLeaks. And this material was true. It wasn't fake. It wasn't what we would traditionally call disinformation or misinformation, but it was reported on in a small way, but later blamed for helping elect Donald Trump. And as a result, a kind of a coalition of news media, tech platforms, and politicians has since demanded that the next time a situation like this takes place, we have to make sure that nobody reports material like that. And so we're now in an analogous situation, a semi-analogous situation, where there's been an explosive report about some emails allegedly belonging to the nominee's son, Hunter Biden. And there's been suppression, and the news agencies have essentially decided we're not going to do what we did in 2016. We're going to shut this off completely.
But this wasn't just Biden. They will run with stuff like the Steele dossier that it has no, obviously can't be fact checked. They will trumpet that because it hurts Trump. And I'm not talking about partisan news outlets like MSNBC, which is just an arm of the Democratic Party. I'm talking about these old traditional media outlets like the New York Times. The kind of language that they'll use, one, they'll marginalize any kind of news, even in this case of the Biden, Hunter Biden's laptop. The Bidens, no one has denied its authenticity. And yet the way they write about it will be to discredit it as black propaganda. I mean, so what's happened within, I think there's kind of a sea change within that traditional media, which I come out of, just a whole new ethic. I mean, I find days when I read the New York Times, it's unrecognizable in terms of how it writes, the language it uses, what it's willing to say, when it has many faults, which you know as well as I do. However, it's really a completely new organization in many ways. Can you talk about that shift? Because I find that very frightening.
Sure, and of course, obviously, you would know this better than I would, but I think traditionally what the New York Times would do with a story like this is they would work very hard to ascertain, first, whether the material was real, and it would wait to come out with some kind of pronouncement about its news value until it had done that. And that is exactly what they don't do anymore. You know, really in the first days after the story broke, they already had a story by Kevin Roos in the paper that the headline was something along the lines of, you know, there was a mistake in 2016 and the Facebook promised to fix it. Well, this is what the fixing looks like, you know, and then they, the lead of that.
Right. Let me, Matt, to interrupt you, because this is the headline, which I take from your Substack. We'll tell people how they can get it. Everyone should subscribe. Facebook and Twitter dodge a 2016 repeat and ignite a 2020 firestorm. The companies have said they would do more to stop misinformation and hacked materials from spreading. This is what the effort looks like. And then I'm reading from your article. Roos, who you just mentioned, notes that, quote-unquote, politicians and pundits have hoped for a stronger response from tech firms ever since Russian hackers and WikiLeaks injected stolen emails from the Clinton campaign into public discourse. This is, again, a quote from him. Since 2016, lawmakers, researchers, and journalists have pressured these companies to take more and faster action to prevent false or misleading information from spreading on their services. The Podesta emails are not false.
I know, exactly.
They're real.
It's a bait and switch. And this has been going on all across the media landscape. But they're doing that. They're saying in the public memory what happened in 2016, they've used the word disinformation or misinformation so many times that people associate those emails with words like that. And so they can get away with saying well, we have to do something to stop this misinformation or disinformation, even though, again, we're talking about things that are real and true, but just happen to come to the public through a means that is, you know, in their minds, infamous. So again, the traditional mission of an organization like the New York Times, and they exist specifically because they have the resources and the training to hunt out whether or not stuff like this is real. They're just skipping straight past that and going to the editorial pronouncement about how this is the kind of material that should be suppressed. And this is what suppression looks like, and good for them. And that's the angle that they're taking right now, which is really extraordinary. It's an amazing change.
Yeah, no, it is. It is seismic. So, Matt, I want to ask you about this podcast, because I don't think it's unrelated. Caliphate, where it's a 5-part series. They interview, it turns out that he's an imposter. You call it correctly, stuff of snuff films. He's talking about stabbing. He claims to have been an Al-Qaeda murderer, and putting people up on crosses and putting daggers in their hearts. It's quite amazing, again, coming out of the culture of the times. It's completely false. It's rabidly salacious. You know, the worst part of court of tabloid trash television. But I think that that's a piece of what's happening here. Can you talk about that, especially back up a little bit for people who aren't familiar with what happened?
Sure. Yeah. So they had a I think it was a 6-part podcast series. And it was the lead reporter was a pretty celebrated figure in the organization. It's Rukmina Kalamachi is, I think, her name, right? And she's been a 4-time finalist for the Pulitzer. And they interviewed this character who's a Canadian-born or a Canadian citizen who's a Muslim who claimed to have gone over to Syria to become a soldier for ISIS. And in the process, he accumulated all these tales of committing horrific acts of violence. And the podcast was essentially based around these graphic descriptions of what he had done while he was in Syria and in other parts of the Middle East. And then he was arrested by Canadian authorities for perpetrating a hoax under a law that I guess that we don't have an analogous law here in the States. But When the Times was presented with this news that their main source in this very acclaimed, significantly trafficked podcast had turned out to be an imposter, their immediate reaction was to deflect and say, actually, one of the purposes of the podcast was to determine whether or not he was telling the truth, which is completely untrue. As Eric Wemple of the Washington Post put it, who incidentally, who's been one of the few media critics who's actually done real work on this kind of stuff lately. They spent the entire podcast really bolstering the credibility of this source and not calling it into question at all. And incidentally, what would be the worth of a podcast like that if there was any question at all about whether or not it was true? It would be a complete waste of time to do the story. So they undermine themselves rather than do what I think a traditional news organization would do, which is to say, okay, we might have a problem here. We're going to look into it. If necessary, we'll bring in an outside auditor to see what went wrong, and we'll come out with all the results of our investigation later. And in the meantime, we apologize. That's exactly what they didn't do anymore. They've learned that audiences now forgive this kind of thing. And if you just pretend that it didn't happen, you can move along and just go to the next thing. And that's now kind of more the modus operandi, which of course wasn't what it was when you worked there. And I think when a lot of other people entered the Times, back in the day.
Well, they will forgive it only if it bolsters the dominant narrative.
Right, exactly. Yes.
If it doesn't bolster the dom, they won't forgive it.
Right.
That's why they've pushed you to the margins of the media landscape.
Right, and you too, obviously, yes.
Yeah. So on the one hand, you have the Podesta emails, the Biden, which is real, being denounced as fake. And you have a complete hoax defended, let's call it what it is, fake news. It's sensationalist garbage. as being perpetrated by the Times. I just want to read, I thought it was a really great paragraph you wrote. You said, now the business, you're talking about journalism, has reversed course, acting like a gang of college freshmen who've just read Beyond Good and Evil for the first time. Objectivity is dead. There's no truth. Everything is permitted. The cardinalate has gone from pompous overconfidence in its factual rectitude to a bizarre postmodernist pose where nothing matters. Man and truth is whatever we can get away with saying. I mean, it's funny, but it's not. That is really what we're documenting here. What do you think the pressures were? Is it commercial? I think to an extent it must be commercial. The Times has bled advertising. It's stumbling into a new media environment that it's not familiar with. What do you think is causing this? Or maybe it's just moral posturing. I don't know.
I think it's a combination of all of those things. Clearly, the commercial aspect of it plays a strong role, because just to take an example of that Caliphate podcast, here you've got somebody giving a firsthand account of crucifying a human being. And that's what you got to do to stay in, you know, to trend on Twitter for like 8 seconds now. You know, you need to come up with stuff like that just to keep getting a requisite number of clicks, just to not lose audience. You need to come up with sensational material, because everybody's hyping things all left and right. So there's enormous pressure now to stretch the envelope of sensationalism in ways that probably didn't exist when I first went into the business, or you did. But that's only part of the picture. The other part of the picture is there's been this segmentation of audience where, you know, the Pew Center did a study this summer where they ask people, you know, what their political affiliations were. You know, if your primary news source was Fox, you know, 93% of those people were Republicans. If your primary news source was MSNBC, 95% of those people were Democrats. With the New York Times, it was 91% of those people are Democrats. NPR, 87%. So all of these news outlets are talking to one audience exclusively. And so they've learned that if they screw up and they make a mistake about the other audience, it's not going to matter. So I think whether consciously or unconsciously, it's sped up their fact-checking process or made it looser, because they know it doesn't really matter. You know, if we make a mistake about this, it's not going to come bounce back at us. If we predict that something's going to happen,
And he is correct. The whole interview can be seen on parian.fm. Let me just conclude our program today with something that we should all be concerned with, but nothing is going to happen because of it. This is from Robert Hunziker from Counterpunch, A Troubling Discovery in the Arctic. A notable satellite telephonic call to colleagues in late October from Swedish scientist Gustafsson of Stockholm University briefly described a haunting discovery. On board the research ship, a massive scientific research vessel equipped with 17 onboard laboratories and library far off the coast of Russia. The doctor reported, quote, this East Siberian slope methane hydrate system has been perturbed and the process will be ongoing. And then they saw this giant, what they're calling a sleeping giant, that has enough carbon firepower to adversely impact the world's climate system. And the expedition discovered methane, which is CH4, that had been securely frozen in shallow subsea permafrost waters forever and ever, and now is stirring, colloquially, meaning the monster of the North is awakened. That's according to their own headline. Now, have you heard about this? And have you heard of how much more powerful methane is over carbon dioxide as global warming? And you have a huge amount, and it's all melting, and that is increasing the temperatures, and that is increasing the warmth of the water, which is adversely affecting the way that the conveyor belt takes warm water from South America up and around Ireland, Iceland, brings cool water back down. And that is also, this warmth is causing hurricanes to intensify, dropping more water, going slower, and being a greater velocity as it goes. This is real stuff. This is what's impacting us right now, and not a single thing is going to be done, not today, and probably not in your lifetime, by anyone in politics. That's the way the system works. And you won't know the truth because of what they were just saying. You can lie about GMOs, you can lie about 5G, you can lie about vaccine safety and efficacy, you can lie about the coronavirus and its lethality to the average person or young people. You can lie about the importance of lockdowns. You can lie about everything. But at the end of the day, reality is still there to meet us. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.